accession number 2 8898 real 5.
Matt Charles with Real 5. You mentioned on these raids into France that you got a couple of aircraft. Was that German aircraft that you shot down?
Three. Oh yeah. Hopefully, just a word. Yes, well, three I think I got, but it was too high to hit the ground. So I saw my shells going into them, so that they were either badly damaged or they would have been shot down. I mean, I could see the bits flying off them.
How much can you remember of that action? Because obviously it would have taken place quite quickly.
Well, there was one I was leading a flight, a little part of the flight of a big formation, the part I was leading, and I suddenly saw four 190s low down below me. And so I took my flight down to behind these. They were slightly ahead and below. So I took my flight down, and I hammered away at the centre one, and I'm sure that was a destroyed because he just tail blew off and things blew out of it. But we were going so fast then because we were in the dive, and my number two, a chap who eventually took over the wing, he was a sergeant pilot then, Sergeant Loud, he got another one, so we got two of those four. And then we pulled away, so I didn't see it. You know, when you pull away, you got to get back into your formation again, or try to, and I didn't see it hit the ground or anything, so they gave me a probable for that, but as far as I'm concerned, I don't think it could have got anywhere. So that was one. Second one was we were escorting some B-26s, American aircraft, bought by the RAF. They were bombing, medium-level bombing targets behind Le Havre, and we were doing close escort on them, and we were attacked by, oh, I don't know, 50, 100, one, many 190s, 109s. And the ones we were always looked out for were the yellow-nosed 109s, because they were the Richthofen squadrons, and they prided themselves on being the best fighter pilots in Germany, I think. And I was number flying number two to Paddy Finucane, who was quite an ace. And one... suddenly saw 109 climb away steeply as we approached, away from the melee going down below, and he was obviously getting height to come down onto us from height, and Paddy saw it, and so he pulled up after it. Then I saw it, and we were going straight up. One time we were almost going vertically up, speed dropping off rapidly. I don't know what happened to Paddy's aircraft, because what happened to him, but I was left with this one 109 coming towards me head on, straight down. So I thought, gee whiz, what's going to happen here? So I thought, well, I got to try and get him. So I raised my nose and got my gun sight. Of course, our closing speed was pretty rapid. And again, I saw my shells hitting him down the side of the fuselage. And of course, he's gone past me. But we didn't have negative G carburetors. If you push, that was before we had the American Stromberg carburetor, which was a negative G carburetor. So if you push the nose forward in a Spitfire, the engine cut, because you weren't getting any feed to the engine. So in the sort of panic of the moment, I pushed the nose. I thought I was going to hit him head on, you know, crash into him. I pushed the nose forward to get underneath him, and my engine cut. It's a cloud of black smoke from the engine and everything else. And I thought, Christ, it's hit me, the bloody engine. Well, of course, we were very heavily briefed on what to do if you're over enemy territory and you're hit. Because we had little compass, one of our buttons on the battle dress was a compass, and we had a map in our sleeve down here, map of the area. And they had little escape packs and things, food packs and little medical pack. Go deep into enemy territory over France as far as you could get before you had to bail out, and then look for a house that looked away from the town, but it was a fairly biggish house that looked as though it had responsible people running it, and then approach them when you could and get away, which I intended to do. So I was going with the engine just sort of firing once every 20 seconds. I thought, well, it's going to stop any minute. So it wasn't giving me any power. I couldn't keep going on it. I was continuing in on the speed I'd picked up in the dive. But I thought, well, I would want to pull up and bail out. Of course, the aircraft had gone. I was totally on my own. The other aircraft in the battle had gone. And I pulled up. And as I pulled up to bail out, because I was going to roll over and bail out so low, bail out. As I pulled up, the engine suddenly fired. I had the throttle, and I'd left the throttle wide open. It burst of power, and the engine fired. I thought, gee whiz, is this engine going to keep going? So I didn't want to touch it for a while. The throttle, if I touch it, it'll stop again. So I just kept going for a while, and it seemed to keep going, so I thought, right, I'll do a sharp turn, low level over the treetops, and head for home. The halves quite a distance from base, so it's right down to the south of the channel. And so I had a treetop flew, and the engine kept going. I thought, well, keep, for heaven's sake, keep going over that water. And it did, and I flew all the way low level and landed at Tangmere. And I hadn't realised until I landed that it was purely the engine stopping through negative G and the carburetor not being fed with petrol. The engine not being fed with petrol through the carburetor. And because normally you never push the nose forward in any combat. It's always either rolling over and pulling through or pulling this way. You always have positive G on. You very rarely have negative G on, and this is a mistake. So I got away with that one, fortunately. But that was the second one I got. And the third one was, we got split up over a dogfight somewhere in France, and coming back over the channel, I was alone, and I was looking around all the time, because I knew that we'd be in a combat area, and as I crossed the French coast, I noticed an aircraft coming up behind me, and I didn't know what the hell it was. I thought, is it one of ours, is it one of theirs? And as it got closer, I'd recognise the shape, because they impressed a tremendous amount of training on us on aircraft recognition. And we used to have a screen in the crew room, and it'd flash for a second of 109 or 190 different angles, and you had to recognise, that's 190, that's 190. Because it's very vital that you recognise what the aircraft is, whether it's one of ours or one of theirs, because a fighter looks like a fighter. A 109 looked very much like a Hurricane or a Spitfire, so a single-engine monoplane. It was a dihedral. I thought, that's it's a 109, definitely. And it was catching me up. The 109F, the latest model, was catching me up. So I thought, Christ. So eventually I just had to do a steep turn back into it. Because he's caught me up, he would have just shot me down if I kept going straight. And we got into a tussle of tight turns and things. And eventually I managed to get inside his turn. Inside his turn, so hardly any deflection at all, and I fired at him, and again I saw that when a 220 millimeter shell hits something, it makes a big splat, and I saw the shells hitting him all down his left hand side, his right hand side actually, inside the turn, and right as far as the cockpit, I saw the cockpit thing go off, but then again, you see, I had to get back because short of fuel. He's speeding then back in towards France, and I had to get back towards England because it was one of these it was way down south somewhere, near the Havre, and quite a long crossing of the water, and the fuel was. So I just turned and came back, but I'm pretty sure I was given a damaged for that. And I can't see how I could have made it. In fact, I think I probably could have. The cockpit, my shells started from behind the cockpit. I could see bits flying off the side of the field, right up to the cockpit. Then part of the cockpit, or the whole of the cockpit, just disintegrated. So I may have actually got him. But you see, an aircraft will keep flying straight for a while. And it just doesn't, unless it explodes altogether, when you do know it. But, so those are three that I'm sure. I mean, I fired at so many more, and whether I hit them or not, I don't know. But those are three that I'm pretty sure I got. Definite.
How did the Spitfire and the 109 compare in that sort of situation?
Unfortunately, throughout the whole of the war, They were always one better than us on the fighters. We started off with a Spitfire. Well, my first combat was in Spitfire, not combat. My first operational squadron was Spitfire 2. Then they upgraded the engine to a Merlin. I can't remember now what it was. Merlin 5, I think, or something like that. And I was in Spitfires. Now, then they brought out, they upgraded their 109E to 109F. Which was a far faster aircraft, and it did away with the struts of the tailplane, and it was just more streamlined and much better performing aeroplane, and it was faster than we were.
Could you outturn it?
You could outturn. The one thing we did have over in nearly all their aircraft was that we could do a tighter circle and not spin out. So we eventually finished up if we were in dogfight in a sort of tight turn, unless you got him immediately in a straight line like the 190 I got, which was a much faster aircraft than we were. But I was zooming behind over there, which didn't see us coming. They didn't see you. Yes, you tight, tight. So then when we got the 190, sorry, the Spitfire 9 was the next aircraft, which was a great leap up. Because that had a dual supercharging system. There's a low level supercharger. A boost kept going until you got to about 16, dropping off to about 18,000 feet, and then you just press a throttle back, press a switch, and the top blower came in. You put the throttle on again, and you got the same amount of boost back. So that was very good. You could get pretty high. But then, you see, they brought out their 190, which was a radial engine aircraft, again, very much superior to the Spit 9. And, of course, they brought out jets at the end of the war, when we were doing long-range escorts on fortresses and our own aircraft. You see these ME-62s, twin jet aircraft, screaming through, and they were tremendously fast, and that's what was superior than never got into a tussle with them, so I don't know what a turning circle was like, but they were just extremely fast. A very good attack fighter against bombers, so they could scream through the formation, hit a bomber and be away, and no one could follow them. So that was that. They were always slightly one above us in the superiority of their aircraft. We never quite caught them up.
And something that sprung to my mind.
There's not much between the Spit 9 with the 60 or 70 series engine in it. American Packard Company in America were making them with Stromberg carburetoring, which would take negative G, you know, a much better aircraft all round, gave a tremendous amount of power. But that was very much like a Messerschmitt 109F. Then they brought out the 109G, which was better again. So they were all just one step ahead all the time. We brought something out, they brought something out a bit better.
Something that springs to mind when you were describing being in action, are there any sort of rules that you would apply when you're in the kind of combat zone of how you would behave?
It really is the survival of the fittest. You don't really think about any rules. I mean, you're just one with the aircraft. It's part of you. You feel as though you are the aircraft. And you just want to stay alive and try and get him.
I was thinking, would you always be constantly looking round? Would you never
the composition of our time, of every minute, was 90% looking outside the aircraft, looking around for, that's why I clean perspective. Looking around for anything else, the dots in the sky above. I think then of the remaining 5%, 3% was keeping formation, and 2% was a quick glance at the instruments to make sure that everything was running all right.
And should you end up in a sort of melee with German fighters, was it important not to fly straight and level, or would you be weaving and diving?
You don't fly straight and level for 1 second. You keep weaving and pulling G, and you know, if you fly straight and level for more than about 5, 10, 20 seconds or something, you're a dead man. No, you don't fly straight and level. That's why most of our chaps who were shot down never saw what shot them down. They were just tooling along, not seeing any enemy aircraft around. And suddenly, whoop, he's nearly always the number 4. As a new guy, he was there in the formation that leads 2, 3 and 4. And he was at last, you know, his back of anybody. We tried to look after his tail. We were looking around all the time at each other's groups. But they'd swoop down and come up behind him, and he'd just disappear. Come back, anybody see, where's Joe? What happened to him? Yeah, I don't know. It was with me when I asked to turn. Just didn't see what happened to him. So if you're new and you're picked off, and the majority of people who were shot down were picked off very early in their flying careers because they just didn't have the, they just weren't used to the mayhem of a dogfight. And, you know, they probably flew strain level, weren't looking around or something. They just didn't see what hit them.
So is it really a constant, you're constantly moving, constantly looking, constantly...
Oh, you're perspiring, you're pulling G, you're hurling around, you're aware of cannon shells just missing your wingtip. You know, it's total bedlam, a dogfight. It's real. You aren't aware of anything except staying alive and trying to get something that's ahead of you. You don't have time to think about anything other than what's on hand, what you're doing. And the big main thing is to keep moving, keep pulling G and weaving. In fact, as soon as we started to go doing the big sweeps into France, as soon as we entered French territory, everybody would weave the whole time. Whether you're being attacked or not, you're just gently weaving. So if anybody did come up trying to get a shot, he'd have to keep changing his deflection. It was difficult to hit a weaving aircraft. So yes, you're on the move the whole time.
Another question: some of the characters you were with in 602 Squadron.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about some of the people you were with at that time and what?
Well, when I first joined Al Deer, who was one of the aces of the war. He got, I don't know, about 20 odd aircraft. Shot down 9 times. I've written a book which I've got here called 9 Lives, which I appear in. And he was a squadron commander. He's 23. He had the DFC in Bar at the time when I joined. And he was a rugged New Zealander. He played for the All Blacks, actually. A really tough sort of guy, big square jawed chap. And he was great. He was just a great fighter pilot and very aggressive, massive aggression. And then when he got tired, he was taken off flying. I was horrified to see this chap who was shot for cowardice in the First World War on television recently. I mean, you can only take so much, you know. I didn't know any fighter pilot who eventually his nerves didn't go and he had to be taken off and given a rest at rest period.
What were his leadership qualities like?
Oh, tremendous. If you've got to be a squadron commander of a fighter pilot, on the whole, there were one or two mistakes, but on the whole, you'd earned it by sheer leadership qualities and aggression and knowing it right, instinctively what was right and what was wrong, which way to turn, which way not to turn. In fact, on 1602, if sometimes when Al Deer was perhaps on sick leave or leave or something, we had a flight sergeant Niven used to lead the squadron, of which most of them were officers, and because he was the best fighter pilot. Eventually he got the commission and he did very well. He went up to wing command and got DFC in 2 bars, but Sergeant Loud, who I took with me on his first operation, but got these 190s, he finished up as wing leader, a wing commander, with DFC and bar and DSO, I think. In civilian life, he'd been a tram conductor. He was only in for the war. When the war finishes out, back tram conducting again or whatever. But, remarkable people we had. Then after Al Deer stepped down, or was stepped down, then we had Paddy Fittigane took over. And he was equally aggressive. He had a tremendous eye. All he thought about was, what am I doing on the next flight? Can I get another Hun, you know? He just had total concentration the whole time. We were led by an extraordinary station commander called Victor Beamish, part of the 3 Beamish brothers, who were all Irishmen, but they played rugby for Ireland. He was a real tough guy as well, square jawed chap. And he, when he first took over, he got all the officers in the officers' mess. And he said, right, we've got to get some efficiencies going here. Because you see, most of the officers in the Office of Defence, they're either accountants with a deputy accountant or a sub-deputy accountant, or equipment officer with a deputy equipment officer and a sub-deputy equipment. People who weren't ever in action, but they did the administration of the station. And they outnumbered us by a long chalk. And so he said, okay. He said, I'm not, he said, you equipment officers, non-flyers, will have to work a bit harder because I'm going to post all your deputies away. They're useless, no good to me. You just work a few more hours like we have to. Because in the summer we were up at 3, didn't get to bed at 11. He said, so you've got to work, start earning your pay now. Oh, dear me, really? Because they had, they started at 9 and they had a long lunch with lots of beers and back, finished at 5, went back to the mess, read paper. They didn't know there was a war on. And then he said, and I noticed the Wing Commander so and so, perhaps the Wing Commander admin, you drive around in a RAF car, you're not doing that anymore, you're going to cycle around. He said, in fact, I shall cycle everywhere. I shall only use my car if I have to go somewhere quickly. And I want to see everybody trotting around the perimeter every day. So we've got to get fit. We're in a war, tough war. And, you know, he galvanized the whole station. And he gave all the pilots into the officer's mess and gave them a lecture as well. And it was incredible. Incredible motivator, and he wasn't supposed to go on sweeps. He was a group captain. The Wing Commander led all the sweeps. Those three squadrons, but he always did. He always got on, fitted in somewhere. He was always determined. He put his pen down right now, and he was last seen with a Czech pilot called Sergeant Tocek, taking on about 30 or 40 190s and 109s. And we never saw him again. He was just shot down in the channel somewhere. Never seen. No one saw him shot down because Tocek was shot down with him. And that was the end of George Beamish. But the leaders in the M group, the squadron commanders and the wing leaders, were on the whole pretty good. You had some who got up there through length of service who got to the end of their tether. And that was a pitiful sight to see those chaps who had to do it, but they'd make some excuse for turning back, saying their engine was rough or something like that. And we said, oh yeah, we thought of us, oh yes, again, he said, yeah. But probably none who heavily decorated would do that. It'd just come to the end of his tether. It couldn't take any more. And, but on the whole, the squadron commanders were picked very carefully and were good.
Are there any qualities that they all shared that you would say, that apart from, say, aggressiveness that you've mentioned, that Paddy Finucane and Al Dear shared as squadron commanders, that you would say that's what makes a squadron commander?
I think they had total commitment and aggression. There are probably misfits in civil life, like Bardo in civil life was, but he had a total commitment to go and get some more homes. And strength of character, fit, very fit men normally.
Were they sportsmen?
Yes, they all played some sports, golf. Well, we had to keep fit. I mean, you've got to be fit to fly as a fighter pilot. You've got to keep fit. Well, it keeps you fit. Flying does it. It's a tremendous amount of exercise involved. I mean, you lose mass. You in perspiration alone, Lord knows how much you lose, but you've got to be fit. And you're pulling 4G and 6G and 7G and that sort of thing. You black out and you pull G. You go, first of all, the peripheral starts to go, then your eyesight starts to go, and eventually you black out altogether. And if you keep pulling the G, because you're still conscious, then eventually you become unconscious because the brain blood drains right out of your head. But, I mean, I've often blacked out in combat, and then you just ease off the stick of it so you can see, because you've got to be able to see or you're dead duck. But, sorry, what was the question you asked me? Well, were they fit? Yes. Yes, we kept ourselves very fit. All this business of going out, the problem drinking pints of beer, you can't do that and keep going. You can't be a fighter pilot with a hangover and fly a combat.
Is that some of the mythology you've seen grow since?
Yes, it's all down to the pub, straps. You know, we just had a good day. We'll have a good day tomorrow. But if we did go down to the pub, we'd probably have a shandy. But and there again, you see, the squadron commander would keep his eye on fellows and say, "Hey, cut that out no more."
Would it be occasionally that people who'd been in the stress of combat for some time may have wanted to start to?
Well, I don't want to mention his name, but we had one wing commander, Kenley, who he was a wing leader when I got there. He was taken off to a sanitarium afterwards, I think. But he was just drunk all the time. He didn't fly. I was only there for a short time, and he was a pianist. He used to play the piano, and he was drinking and everything. And then he was hospitalised for the rest of the war. But I think just to sort of curb his nerves or something. But I was only a very young lad, 18. I didn't. These were superheroes to me. You look around and see what's going on. You see this wing commander drunk as an owl or the piano, and you think, what the hell's he saying? Oh. But I was aware of it. I thought, well, and we all were, is that what you call it? Yeah. And the poor chap, he had to go. I'm not sure whether he was the chap who shot down the first enemy aircraft in the war or not. A fellow with a similar name to that, but to his, I won't name him. But he was a mess, total mess. He'd had it.
And what about your fellow pilots? Obviously not squadron leaders. So who, is there anybody who springs to mind there?
Well, yeah, lots of them do. I mean, you can't fly with people. And the changes, you see, we lost a lot of people. And they kept changing. Chaps would be the squadron for a week or 2 weeks and then they'd disappear.
Again, is that some form of the kind of mythology that's grown up, that you're all in the squadron together? Is it really a very movable, changeable
force? No, you're very much a team. You're very proud of your squadron. And you've normally three squadrons to a wing, and 602 at the time, there's my squadron, 602 squadron, City of Glasgow squadron, 452, which was the first Australian fighter squadron, and 485, which was the first New Zealand fighter squadron. And we were always competing with each other to do better than we could. We were very much a united team. We flew with each other every day, and you just knew how the other person was going to react and everything.
And were there a number of nationalities within? Obviously, you mentioned.
Yes, in 602 was very mixed. We had a Frenchman, we had a Dutchman who unfortunately was killed quite quickly after he joined. We had, I think we had a couple of Canadians. I mentioned a Belgian fellow, a Czech. We were quite an assortment. But the Australians, the New Zealand squadrons, kept theirs pure. You know, they just had Australians or New Zealands. We were a very mixed squadron, the 602. But it was just interesting that we had all thinking along the same lines. I mean, you couldn't have told from their behaviour that they were any other than English, because they adopted English ideas and they flew our way and they were taught by us and all the rest of it. Although some had been pilots in their own countries before they were overrun, and then they somehow escaped and came across and joined the RAF.
Did they have a different attitude towards the Germans, maybe, than yourselves?
The Poles hated them. Absolutely. In fact, I was sitting in the mess one day, and there was a Polish fighter pilot. This is later on when I was, but there was actually a Polish squadron, 303 squadron, at Coldershaw on the wing. Ourselves, 303, and I can't remember what the other squadron was called. But there was a Polish squadron, and this Polish chap was reading the paper, and I just happened to be somewhere near him, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he was staring at a picture of one of Hitler's men, Himmler or something like that. They took his cigarette out, and he just screwed it into the face of this chap. He didn't know that I was watching him. He just built up. Well, yes, they absolutely hated him. That's why the first Polish squadron were really good. They just tore into everything. A bit ill-disciplined, but they just wanted to get out of the Germans because Poland was being decimated and they knew it.